lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. A final gift for my wife. In that moment, I received some semblance of hope. An opportunity to grieve on alone. And your son took that from me.
Hakon stole that from me. Killed that from me! People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Welcome to the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast. Look at the entire John Wick franchise.
Bonjour, Monsieur Wick, and welcome to La Resistance.
Join Garrett.
Well, your little act of uncivil disobedience inspired me, John. I'm branching out, spreading my wings.
Matt.
You working again?
No, just sorting some stuff out.
And Adam.
This life follows you.
As they earn their coins by reviewing each film of the Keanu Reeves starring franchise, leading up to a review of Ballerina, released by Lionsgate Films earlier this year.
30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
So unholster your ears in these confines, percolated media listeners.
I'm not asking you to kill anyone.
The Percolated Media John Wick Retrospective begins now.
If you would be so kind as to follow me.
John Wick, released October 24th, 2014. Budget was $25 million. Box office, $86 million. And this is directed by Chad Stahelski and David Leitch, although he's not credited. They both directed this. We'll get to it. All right, speaking of getting to it, Matt, it took us this long. We were going to do this, as you mentioned last week, we were going to do this for the fourth John Wick film, but we had Batman and other things to cover. Here we are, finally getting to John Wick. Matt, are you excited?
Yeah, this is probably the most excited I've been for a retro in a long time, probably since...
Turn of the Corner?
No. I'd rather stand in traffic than watch any of those movies again. I'd probably say this is the franchise that's nearest and dearest to me, probably since like Mad Max. Not just because they both have female spinoffs as the reason that we're doing the retrospective to begin with, but as far as like what I go to the movies for, I mean, this on the surface, a lot of things I enjoy.
Adam, excited to get to John Wick?
Oh, yeah. This is... I mean, I'm glad we got a reason to do it. I think there's some good discussions to be had. This is just, you know what? Screw you, Scorsese. Cinema. Let's go.
Before we get to the movie, let's talk about our directors here. Now, David Leitch, he was a stuntman. He was a stunt coordinator. And Chad Stahelski is the one I really wanted to talk about because his career started as the stunt double for Brandon Lee on The Crow. Brandon Lee called him up and said, look, I got this great big project. I would like you to be a part of it. Stahelski goes to it. And we all know what happened on that set. And Stahelski was traumatized by that, as you could imagine. Brandon Lee dies, and Stahelski is the one who they use to double for Brandon Lee after he had passed. The scenes of him that they show was Stahelski instead of Brandon Lee. That really wore him down. Adam, we were in high school around that. I mean, you'd think that would really traumatize someone on the set, right?
Absolutely. That was one of those... It changed Hollywood. I mean, they changed the way practices are done. Changed some of the practices and the way shoots are done. So, yeah. I mean, you could see people completely getting out of the game after something like that.
Well, he certainly would have been justified if he never wanted to work in the industry again. I don't think anyone would second guess that decision at all.
But him and Leitch, they became friends while they were in the stunt circuit, and they don't come into this movie for a while. This thing, wow, what a story this movie has. If people haven't watched it, there's a documentary out called John Wick is Pain. I watched it before this. I took a lot of notes from that. And if people are really curious about these two, they get into their backstory a lot in that. So I'm not going to get too far into it. What I will say is the guy who wrote this is a guy by the name of Derek Kolstad. This guy... Matt, if we were to do the rest of his filmography, it would feel like Children of the Corn all over again because he did a terrible Steve Austin movie called The Package with Dolph Lundgren, which is one of the worst things I ever saw, and I believe I reviewed it as well. The studio liked this idea, although at that time it was called Scorn. they liked the script enough to pick it up, and they had a few directors in mind for this that were not these two. Kurosawa wrote the script with Clint Eastwood or Paul Newman in mind. Matt, can you see an older John Wick in this? Can you see an older person like them or maybe Bruce Willis playing this character?
On the page, absolutely, because this script, if I'm looking at this like from the direct translation process, there's nothing in there that mentions his age directly or a description of him physically. I mean, part of that, the character is surrounded in so much myth and legend that you could cast anybody and it'd be believable. I mean, we live in an era where back in the 70s, the idea of casting Charles Bronson in Death Wish was looked at as, what the hell are you doing? And certainly Clint Eastwood, the man has kicked ass on cinema longer than we've all been alive. Almost combined. Like, if we took your ages and mine, that's probably how long Clint Eastwood's been making movies. And there is something interesting. This kind of has the Death Wish approach to it of his, you know, quote-unquote origin. And in the case of Paul Newman, he was the everyman. So I totally could have seen him in this part if you were... I mean, there would have come a point where he was too old, and save for Clint Eastwood. Like, it would have had to have been in a certain period while they physically could still do it. But yeah, I could see a lot of people in this role.
Adam, what about you? If you take Keanu Reeves out of this, can you see it as a vehicle for an older actor?
So you're asking, does somebody have a certain set of skills?
Yes.
That he's honed over a lifetime? Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think you get towards a different audience at that point. I think Bruce Willis is a different sensibility than somebody like Clint Eastwood, Liam Neeson, some of those people. But yeah, I absolutely think you could do so, but it's a different movie. I think visually, musically, and stunt-wise, it's a different film than what we get. But sure, an old man I think they called that movie Red, and it was out, you know, about the same time as this one. I'm so sure.
All right, let's talk about our star, Keanu Reeves. Once they decided that they weren't going to go the old route, they decided to go to Keanu, which, by the way, he wasn't exactly a young buck when he made this.
No, he was already in his 50s.
He was already in his 50s. And the other thing about this, and the reason why I was not excited to see this, was because he had made a string of bombs leading up to this, to the point where his bankability went way down. And when he was suggested by producers for this, the studio batted it down. They were like, he's not bankable. If you get the star of 47 Ronin, which, by the way, is one of the worst movies ever made, it's so bad. And Man of Tai Chi, those are just bad movies. And Keanu was in such a career slump, it took something like this to bring it back. Matt, were you aware of that slump? And did you think about that before you saw this?
Oh, that slump is why I had no desire to go see this. I thought this was just, my thought was, why is this not in the $5 bin at Walmart back when that thing existed? Because Keanu Reeves was bordering on being a punchline by this point. After the Matrix series ended, he made a string of just either being outright miscast, like Constantine as an example, or making movies like Street Kings or Scanner Darkly, which don't perform well. I would have totally been on the studio side. He certainly was not bankable. I guess that's why I don't sit in that chair and I sit watching these movies rather than making the decisions, because there were plenty of other bankable stars. I mean, Adam mentioned Liam Neeson. I mean, this might as well, if you're looking at this from bird's eye view, might as well be a Taken seat origin. If you, because I think that movie is really responsible in a lot of ways for this wave of older actors getting second chances in different roles. Now, the difference with Keanu, he started, like, part of his career, a big part of his career, two phases were built on being an action star. So unlike a Liam Neeson, he had that in his portfolio. But unlike Liam Neeson or a Denzel Washington when he did The Equalizer, which came out like 2 months before this, ironically, Keanu, not exactly known for being a great thespian.
Yeah, in fact, the one they went after before they offered it to Keanu was Johnny Depp. But
oh God,
he turned it down, one of many bad decisions he would make that decade. So they went with Keanu, and that's a nice comparison. I could go with that.
Keanu's not a selling point. I mean, I'm sorry, in most things. Look, I like Keanu. I think he's a dude that I would hang out and have an amazing time with. Keanu Reeves is not a good actor. As an actor, he can put on a presence. He can make a hell of a movie. But dude ruined Bram Stoker's Dracula for me. And I'm still bitter about that almost 34 years later.
Maybe that's why Johnny Depp said no, because remember, he was supposed to play that part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look, Bill and Ted is fun as all hell. but I watched things like Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. Okay. God. I can't remember if it was Johnny Mnemonic or Chain Reaction that I saw in the movie theater, but that was it. I was done. Sorry. Devil's Advocate. And I got a soft spot for that movie for all the wrong reasons. That's just crazy. The Matrix was based on the concept of that film for me. You know, it wasn't Keanu. So I think to see this movie, and tell you what, and I'll do it now before we get into it. I didn't see this movie until after 2 came out.
Oh.
Because I didn't care. Keanu Reeves is in a movie. Yeah, good for him. There's never a year where Keanu Reeves doesn't have a movie coming out. But that doesn't mean I'm going to see it.
So on the Keanu Reeves acting point that you made, I put Keanu in the same camp that I do with John Wayne or Schwarzenegger, where I don't think it's that they're devoid of talent. I just think they're very unconventional and have to be utilized correctly. Keanu's problem, a lot of times, he was just in movies that did not suit him. Dracula, Much Ado About Nothing, he is abysmal in that movie. And Kenneth Branagh is like the guy who can make people do Shakespeare presentably, but Keanu is just incapable of it. I think Keanu's problem, a lot of it was just he's got limited range. Remember when he started out in River's Edge and people were like, wow, this guy's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Then we kind of realized for a while that's all he was capable of. Because like Parenthood, he played a similar role. Bill and Ted's different, but I also think that by the time we got to the third one, he forgot how to play that role because it's been so long. Alex Winter, no problem. But because Keanu became John Wick for so long, I just think he forgot how to play that. So I think his problem was he's just been dreadfully miscast in a lot of stuff. I mean, God, Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oof.
or The Lake House with Sandra Bullock.
Oh, I saw both of those in theaters.
Like yeah. he's not a romantic lead because he doesn't have that type of
projects. Because you look at something like I watch The Replacements every other year and enjoy it every time I do.
And he's fun in stuff like Speed and Point Break, but it's not, he's not a Bruce Willis or someone like that where he can really, you know, take different roles and do it. I will say his best performance, and I'm going to get punched in the face for this, so I'll say it in duck, The Gift.
Oof. Yeah, he's good in that.
I expected that from Garrett.
Yeah.
The movie's not great, but he's very good at it. By this point, oh my God, I don't think he made a movie I had liked since A Scanner Darkly, and I don't like that movie because of him.
Oh, by the way, if you watch that documentary, Reeves is exactly how you'd expect him to be, Adam. You mentioned that you'd like to have a beer with him. Every single time he spoke, because I watched that documentary with Jen, she just kind of put her head in her hands like, oh my God, this is my hall pass. He just is goofy as all hell, but he's definitely somebody. When I was living in Hollywood, I wanted to hang with him, and he's definitely how you would expect him to be. But he said this was a very personal film for him because a little over 20 years ago, he had a girlfriend named Jennifer Sim, and she died in a car accident. And she had been at a party, coincidentally thrown by Marilyn Manson, who has a song in this. And after she was dropped off at home by another guest, she had a lot of alcohol in her system, and she, for some reason, decided to go back. She ended up crashing into a line of cars and dying almost instantly. And this was, by the way, 2 years after their daughter was stillborn and had passed away. So he brought a lot of baggage to this. And that's one thing I will always respect about Keanu. You know, he's one who gives back. I know people who worked on the Matrix movies. And he was one who, he made a lot of money off those things. And he was good at spreading it around. And he does have the reputation of being, you know, the coolest guy in Hollywood, the nicest guy in Hollywood, the one who will pat you on the back on the train, stuff like that. But it's well warranted. And this was something that if you didn't know any better, you would want to root for him to succeed. And I'm glad that he was able to get a career renaissance with this.
Well, I think that's what helped him. I remember when this premiered at Fantastic Fest, I had a friend who covered it. He did a Q&A afterwards, but he stayed much longer than he had to be. Just people shooting the shit. Like, they weren't even asking questions about the movie. And that's how I heard about this movie. I had a friend who, part of it was he saw Tusk right before it, and he hated it so much that anything would have been an upgrade. But he walked out of John Wick, he texted me immediately and said, hey, I know this movie is not on your radar, but when John Wick comes out in a theater, knowing you, I implore you to go see it. And I'm like, all right. And I kind of fought it. I was like, I don't want to see Keanu, and nothing in the trailer was making it stand out. I knew who the directors were, just being a film buff, but it's not like you're selling me on John Woo or anything like, or Tony Scott. So I still went in very skeptical. And to Keanu's point, I think much like Schwarzenegger now, he's totally playing into his image. Look at the role, like
definitely
Shadow the Hedgehog, Toy Story 4. Shows up in a SpongeBob movie. Like, he's just having fun now. These movies are to him what Mission Impossible is to Tom Cruise.
I think so, too. There's a movie he did with Ali Wong. Shit, and I can't remember the name of it. But she's looking to date, and she's dating Keanu Reeves. So he's playing himself, and he's completely amped up and playing a caricature of himself. And he has fun, and I appreciate that. And it's why so many movies with him in it I will see. And it's because I appreciate the guy. And Garrett, to your point, the way he treats people, the way he treats crew and other people around Hollywood is to be admired, because not many stars, and it, like it or not, he is a star, will do that.
Like Matt and like Adam, I was not excited for this at all. Another thing it had going against it was being released by Summit, which had released the Twilight movies, and I'm thinking, what are they doing releasing this thing? There were so many things where I was like, I don't want to go near that. But
yeah, and Lionsgate was the, mm-hmm. I guess, the parent partner of Summit, but outside of the Saw movies, which had died by this point, they weren't putting out hits.
Exactly. I missed this in theaters. I was not excited for it. I was not obligated to review it. So I did not pay for a ticket. I did not go see this. The way I saw this was, I don't know how, I think I had a rough night and I was spending the night at a friend's house. And we sat on the couch and he's like, let's watch this. And he pulled out John Wick and I'm like, Keanu, I don't really want to watch it. And he had a big screen TV with a nice surround system. And we put this thing on and I was blown away. I was like, man, I want to watch that again. And so when I went home the next day, I watched it again. I loved it so much.
So I got to tell my theater story then.
Oh,
so
go ahead.
I do go see it. I walk out of the theater. I walk around, buy another ticket, and watch it again instantly.
Oh, that's funny.
Like, I don't think I've ever done that right for another movie. But, and it wasn't just because I had time to kill, which sometimes I will do that, but I'll go see something else.
Yeah, I've done that.
It was a long time. Like, at that point, I had not seen an action movie that wowed me the way that that one did in years. Probably since, like, when I watched The Road Warrior as a kid. Now, this is a totally different beast entirely. But I think one of the things that also helped this movie was the word of mouth. This thing did have a very strong, almost cult-like pull around it, where everyone you talked about, have you seen John Wick? Have you seen John Wick? No, I'll get to it eventually. And people were saying, no, you got to go check it out. And I think the fact that it made as much money as it did was strictly on word of mouth alone. By this point, we were already being dominated by the big tentpole movies like X-Men, Captain America this year, Guardians of the Galaxy. So the fact that this stood out amongst all those and came out in like October.
Yeah, the end of October.
Which I guess makes sense, because I think this guy kills as many people in this movie as Michael Myers did in all the Halloween movies combined. Because if you look at this from a perspective, it is a horror movie.
Adam, you mentioned you didn't see this until after you saw part two. What did you think initially when you watched it?
It was one of those, I want to say it was after part two came out on disc. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm hearing it's good. Fine, I'll go ahead and watch the first one. And I was just like, damn, it's a shame I missed this. Mm-hmm. You know, that was my first thought, is it's a shame that because of perception or because I didn't care, busy young kids, that I didn't get a chance to see it in theaters, because I wish I had that opportunity. You know, I'm glad when theaters will re-release second run, third run films before new ones come out. I wish they do it a little more often, since AMC can't pull shit out for profit. Yeah, I will always regret not seeing one or two in a theater.
Yeah, I started watching them in theaters at part two, and I haven't stopped since.
And to be fair, I also joined the cult, because I was walking around like a Jehovah's Witness. Have you heard the good word? It's called John Wick. Like I was recommending this to people who, even like my mother, who has no interest in action movies. I'm like, go see this. And she's like, why? I'm like, okay. So they kill his dog and he goes on a rampage. And she's like, oh, that's totally justifiable. Fuck those people. And she went to go see it.
Matt, you and I were friends around that time. I think you recommended it to me too. And
yeah, I told you. I'm like, you know, mm-hmm. I saw this. I put this in my top 10 and people are like, are you insane that year? I'm like, look, we need to stop judging movies based on genre and focus on quality. Because quite frankly, this was better than at least half of the movies that were nominated for Best Picture that year at the Oscars.
A couple more points I want to make before we get to the plot, which will take about 30 minutes. But
coming off Mission Impossible.
Yeah, this was this joy.
It's like a dream.
Yeah. This was a complete joy. When producers were looking for a director, it was actually Reeves who lobbied for both Stahelski and Leach, as they had both been trying to direct features for a long time, and they had both worked on The Matrix. And Reeves, being the guy who, as I mentioned, gives back, he lobbied for these guys. The studio didn't want to bring them on. They wanted to bring on an established action director, but Reeves fought for them, and the rest is history. You can thank him for them being here. There's one more name I need to mention behind the scenes. If you watch that documentary, there's a part where the script was greenlit. They were all set to shoot this thing, but they were about $10 million short.
I love that story.
$6 million short of actually having the funding to start shooting. It was coming down to the wire, and of all people, Eva Longoria of Desperate Housewives fame wrote a check for $6 million, got this thing off the ground. Let me tell you, I see people gambling every day at my job. They don't win shit. I want to gamble with Eva Longoria because goddamn, that chick must be rich as hell for backing this thing and actually getting it off the ground.
That is such an amazing, and it was one of those, you know, like urban legends really quick that is completely true. And I love it. And to me, it's like the writer, the director, her as a producer coming in. I think it's something we're going to talk about throughout all of this. Relationships matter. And who you are as a person matters. And it shows in getting this film done. And I appreciate the fuck. I think that is awesome.
Yeah. And if this starred like Bruce Willis or someone, like, there's no chance somebody would have forwarded that money, because I heard he didn't treat people the nicest way on some of his sets.
All right. So we start off with a radio broadcast, and we see a car crash right into a trailer going maybe 20 miles per hour. And we see Reeves, he's inching his way out, bloodied, as he watches a video on his phone of himself and a woman. We have no idea who she is. And that's how we tease the beginning here. This is a beginning similar to a movie in the franchise we just discussed. In Mission Impossible 3, we saw Ethan Hunt tortured by Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we spend three-fourths of that movie finding out how he got there, as well as how he resolved the situation. The only difference here is that we didn't have two movies to get to know this John Wick character until we meet him in the situation. Boys, how do we feel about the opening frames of this?
So, I like the starting at the end for this reason. Because this movie, on the surface, if I'm looking at this from a story level strictly, it is a run-of-the-mill revenge story. Like, we've seen this type of, all the tropes in this movie done a million times. And what do they say in a lot of those revenge stories? If you're going to go out, dig two graves. This is setting up that he might just die at the end of this movie, and you have a full cyclical story that beginning, middle, end. Like, this is his last ride. So I like that this is permeating that idea in your mind. And also, for a movie that's 90 minutes, maybe just a tad bit more, it front loads everything without overwhelming you, or without a ton of dialogue. So much of this is visual. And I think that's a lost art in not just action movies, but filmmaking in general.
Don't forget, too, they really didn't have much budget to have the production work on this. So it's kind of a necessity, I think, which works for this movie.
I hate this trope. Do not show me the end of the film at the beginning. I think it's a way for you to not know how to finish your movie. So when I'm initially watching this for the first time after hearing so much, I'm just like, ugh, really? This is how lazy and bad your screenwriting is initially. Now, and especially being that we got multiple movies, I appreciate what they were doing, but in general, this is a trope I can almost never get behind.
Did you have this problem with MI3?
Different. That's not the first movie in a franchise. Okay. And it was changing things up, and that's not the literal end of the film. It's kind of the halfway point.
Yeah, you're right. So we see John wake up in this very lavish house as he gets cups of coffee, and we see he obviously lives alone. All right, boys, let's get to it. How do we like Keanu Reeves in this title role?
There was something really nice about showing who he is as a person, knowing what this film is. And going into it, you can never avoid knowing that this is a guy that's a kid. If you have any marketing whatsoever, even back in 2014, you know. So showing him just as a guy, I think, is a great way to humanize who he is without, you know, showing him be wounded or injured or anything else. I think you kind of need the first part, if that's the end of the film, if you're going to do this. But I like this part, just showing him as a guy. And this opening, God, it's only like 5 minutes of explaining why he is where he is done so succinct and so well.
In addition, this movie is all about duality and being in pairs, which we'll talk about throughout the movie. So I also like that the movie does not have to tell you with spoon feeding exposition. You see two coffee cups, you see an additional sink, you see he was alone in the bed. This movie doesn't treat you like you're an idiot. And I greatly admire that for something that on the surface is a disposable action movie made for audiences who just want to watch, you know, mass murder for 90 minutes. It's a lot more thoughtfulness in this opening. It also depicts that it's setting an appropriate time where he's still not come to terms with what happened to his wife. And because of that, it's why he gets taken advantage of when the mobsters break in. Like, that's kind of the moment where he snaps out of this, I don't want to call it false life, but his new life is taken from him. And it makes sense that, given how he fights at the end of the movie, the question is like, why didn't he just kick their ass at the beginning? Well, because of the state he's in currently. Like, he's clearly not that guy anymore, and it's compounded by the fact that he lost his wife. Not in the cliche thing of being on a job and she's in the crossfire. No, she dies for something he can't control. Some kind of, you know, she's got McGregor syndrome. We don't know exactly what it is. But I think it's great. I mean, it's basically the opening of Pixar's Up for the first 10 minutes.
Holy crap, you're right.
You are so right.
Like, it's the same thing where it's minimal dialogue, all visual, and it's him alone in his house.
You know, I hate referencing it. I promise this will be the last time I do. But one more thing I wanted to mention about John Wick is Pain is there's a female producer interviewed on that who is absolutely hilarious. And she said when they didn't have the money to shoot the action scenes, they shot Keanu Reeves in this house. They had like 40 minutes of footage of him in this house. And she's like, are you ever going to have him do anything else? She thought it was just terrible that he was sitting here acting next to this fake dog, you know, the one that's dead in his arms later on and everything else. And she's like, this is the worst production I've ever been on. Little did she know what was coming up.
Well, it's also important because this movie plays to Keanu's strengths.
Oh, yes. I know
he doesn't have a lot as an actor, certainly with range. But much like Schwarzenegger, he's very good with facials. And he's very good. He internalizes too much. I think that's been his biggest problem. In this movie, he is allowed to do that and emote without talking, which I think that sounds like a backhanded compliment, although I certainly wouldn't give it to him because he'd kick my ass before I have time to blink. But it's all about playing to the strengths of your stars. If they're not like Schwarzenegger, not the greatest actor in the world, but you give them the right parts, and he excels. It's the same thing here. Like, maybe it's my generation. When I think of Keanu Reeves, like his legacy, when he lives to be 150, because he probably will, I think I'll remember him as John Wick more than anything else.
So we cut to John in the hospital with his wife as a guy in a suit just lingers in the background. And we have flashes to anniversaries past. We're seeing scenes of the wake as Willem Dafoe gives his condolences. I had completely forgotten that Willem Dafoe was in this movie.
I think one of the things that really populates this out, and again, talk about relationships and stuff. How do you get the people in this film for such a low budget, kind of sleeper type of movie? You know, that you got Willem Dafoe, that you get, we'll discuss some of the other ones as we go through, is just mind blowing because you fill out this universe in a very textured way that I love. And seeing Willem here at the early onset is just like, I had no idea when I watched this film, and I forget every time until he shows up.
Well, I think when we get into the later films, I think it's because they want to be associated with John Wick. We'll talk about Lawrence Fishburne next week. But
yes,
I think as somebody who was a producer, I will say for this first film, you call in a lot of favors. You know somebody who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows Willem Dafoe. And Keanu Reeves comes off as a charming motherfucker, so I guarantee this was a favor that was called in, as well as John Leguizamo. He's only in this for two scenes, maybe. So you just call in a lot of favors, and it works for this because one big compliment I want to give is I love the fact that John Wick knows so many people. We don't have a background of that, but we're getting little hints that he has a reputation and people know him. Later on, the cop is going to show up and he's going to say, oh, John, working again, huh? As he just kind of glances over at a dead body in his house. This is all stuff that world builds without really being in your face.
So I was shocked to see Willem Dafoe. I had no idea. Although I think this was him saying, I thought Keanu was going to be in Speed 2 when I signed on and I got fucked. So this is my chance to work with him. But this is also, I think, a smart call because Keanu Reeves is like Brock Purdy, where if you surround him with great talent, he can flourish. And this movie is peppered, this franchise is peppered with great, not just character actors, but Willem Dafoe's got a resume that's as long as his reported dick is, if you listen to people talk about that. But he also adds legitimacy to the context of assassins being not a cult, but like it's its own world. And clearly this is a guy who's lived in it for a long time. And also I like that all the information about John Wick that we're told is through other people. It never comes from him.
Yes.
He never has to explain himself. He never does any like inner monologue about like, oh, I have this anger inside me and I got to let it out when he's returning to his old life. It's all through other people and how they perceive John Wick. Like, this movie is the, to use the Clint Eastwood analogy, he is like Max or the Man with No Name, where he is a mix between myth and legend. And a lot of times it's more of like a ghost story.
You know what? If he would kill, he's the Dark Knight Returns.
Well, it's funny. He played that. Technically, he played Batman.
He played Batman.
Did he?
And Lego.
Super Pets.
Super Pets. He voiced Batman.
So Defoe says that he's just checking up on an old friend, as he wishes John well. And we're having lots of rain here to build up a mood.
I love that this movie indulges in cliches, but there's always like a wink and a nod, because this is the most cliched thing. Mm-hmm. Pouring rain, gray skies, everybody in black suits at a funeral. Like, this is as archetypical as it gets, but the movie never has to apologize for indulging in cliches.
We go back to modern day as John receives a COD package / dog kennel. He opens the card and it's from Helen, sending him something new to love. And she tells him to find his peace. So she went back in time. This was something that I scratched my head over. This was so weird that she sent him this, what, in the afterlife? Where's this coming from? Matt, can you explain this?
Yeah, she must have did this when she was in hospice at the hospital. Like, arrange this. She knew she had limited time, wanted to give him a surprise, and likely she knew she was going to go under and not come out. So I think there is a through line. Like, to me, this doesn't bother me as far as, like, when did this happen?
Oh, yeah, it must be. I got no issues with this at all. To me, this is, she knows he needs to love something. She was that thing he loved that got him out. And without that thing to love, he's going to be broken all over again. And she knows that this dog will be the one to do it. And he is resistant at first. So yeah, she knows she's dying. She sets this up to give him that next step to carry him forward without her there. And I got, can we just say, two retrospectives in a row, we got Moynihan sisters showing up.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This is the one that married Tom Brady.
Yes. But yeah, I love that. To me, it says something about Helen. It says something about their relationship. And I think it's beautiful.
And you could also infer, because the movie never gives you an answer, if she knew he was a hitman. Like, was this a true lies situation where she had no idea until, like, it was revealed? Mm. So if you abide by that logic of her knowing, this is like a tether to say, this will give you something to keep you out of what you gave up.
Mm. Yeah, that never crossed my mind that she wouldn't know. That's a good point.
There's no force called the Impossible Mission Force. Oh, wait, that was last retrospective. So, okay, so this movie borders on exploitive, considering what they do to this dog later. But my God, Cujo, this isn't. This dog is fucking adorable, and they shoot those eyes as often as they can.
Of course, they had to get the most adorable puppy imaginable.
And these beagles, I mean, they're adorable dogs, but they smell. They're tough to train. Yet this one arrives fully trained somehow.
Oh yeah, this dog is, I guess she paid for him to go to like breeding school, because if you know beagles, they're used as detection dogs in a lot of worlds. So the fact that it's already well trained, I mean, that's the greatest gift she could have given him.
Yeah.
John's woken up by an alarm as he grabs his paper and the dog does his business. He hops in the car with John and they go to a gas station with some guys that John's really going to get to know later. One compliments John on his Mustang and asks how much he's selling it for. John says it's not for sale, as he compliments John's dog as well, and they wish him a good day. So somehow, in the midst of this, he drops the dog off and goes for a drive through an open road. I guess this is to show that John's good at driving, but other than that, is there really a point to this scene? Because we don't really see how good he is at fighting. Why do we have to see him drive here?
It's his, it's what he does in his spare time. Ethan Hunt climbs giant rocks with no rope. He drives cars, and it's also to show that he's well connected. Like, he knows everybody. He can get into like an abandoned airfield, and it's also right next to Leguizamo's shop, isn't it? So maybe he helps run it. What else is he gonna do in his spare time? I mean, he loves that car as much as he loves his wife.
Yeah,
based on the lakes he goes to. So you know, you don't keep that kind of car in a cage.
To me, both of these parts here, we're starting to populate and build this out, and I love that it's not spoon-fed. You are experiencing this film as it sets out. So the punk ass kid, you know, responds to him in Russian, "All bitches are for sale," or something like that. And John Wick responds in Russian. And we see it in this really just elaborate, this font, you know, whenever they do the captioning, which I think is fantastic, because there's just something magical about the way they're building out this world. And then to go from that to seeing John Wick do this, it's just, you're peppering in without explaining it for 20 minutes. It's show, not tell. And for a movie that is so crisp and so short, it still feels fully fucking fleshed out by the end of it because you took us on the journey.
To that point also, unless you've seen the marketing, if you're into this movie blind, you have no idea what's coming.
Right.
That yep. he was an ex-hitman. Like, there's no indication. When he talks to Marcus at the cemetery, they never mention that they used to kill people. He just says checking up on an old friend. That could mean, like, his coworker at the office. Like, that has so many indications. And to Adam's point, this movie is a perfect example of how to front-load exposition. They get it all out of the way. And even then, it's not paragraphs. Most of it's the visual entirely. So this is a great movie to, if I was teaching writing, certainly with action movies, I think this is a modern example of how to make it work.
So we go back to John falling asleep next to the dog in bed. He wakes up in the morning again as the dog barks and John gets up to take him outside. As he's walking, he's taken out by the thugs from the previous day, and we hear the dog scream and we see the thug walking away from it. So we know that the dog is dead. And this guy who had to do this, of course, it's done behind a couch. So they took the dog away, obviously, before they did this. But the guy who even is implied killed this dog felt so bad afterwards, even though he was kicking nothing. But God, that dog scream. Oh my God, it gets me every time.
Okay, so as tasteless as this is from like a moral standpoint, because killing dogs, like that's a cliche in and of itself in movies. But the fact that they make that the driving force of him getting revenge is kind of like they're laughing at that trope, that they're taking it to the furthest extreme. And I will give them credit. This could have been gratuitous. This could have been like a 5-minute sequence, but it's done within a minute and a half. It's about as classy as you could do given the circumstances.
And they had to fight for this. The studio didn't want this. These two directors had to fight to keep this in. And I don't know if the studio was trying to get them to show the aftermath or what, but they had to fight. And I'm glad they did, because you're right. It being the driving force. Come on, I love dogs as much as anybody. I could see how this could drive somebody, especially with the death of his wife, to go as revengeful as he does.
Well, man, it hurts to see, and it justifies everything he does and then some. And I think that's where it's effective. You are instantly on his side. There is no questions.
It's also the, you know, if it was a cat, nobody would have said anything.
You said it, not me.
I'm just saying, like, we nonchalantly kill cats in movies all the time, but whenever it's a dog, there's always this hoopla. But like I said, it's not, this could have been very tasteless and gross, but it's here. We got to do it. Let's leave the true horror to your imagination, but you still see the body and you see him.
Blood. There's a trail of blood.
Yeah, you see a trail of blood. You see he gets the shit kicked out of him, but I feel like that's his, it's the equivalent of Arnold sitting in the chair in Total Recall, where like a switch in his brain gets reactivated and now he's like, it's like the Manchurian Candidate almost, where they said the trigger word and now he's like snapped.
Well, it's implied that they slit his throat. So
yeah, I mean, but this is also very Death Wish, like the whole losing your family and going on a one man crusade. The difference is in Death Wish, he was Paul Kersey's just a regular middle aged guy. As we find out, there's a lot more to this guy than you would assume looking at him.
So we see John sitting with the dog and burying it. Boy, he didn't even get to name this poor puppy.
No, his wife did it for him.
Oh, that's right. Daisy, right?
Yeah.
We cut to the car, driving to Leguizamo's car repair place as he asks, where'd you get that car? Second time reviewing Leguizamo this year. He was in more of Kick-Ass 2 than he is here. Here, he only gave a 15-hour day. Nice day at the office. We're cutting from him telling the guys who brought the car in to leave, with John telling him that they're Vigo's men. After clearing up that he only works for Vigo, Aurelio tells them to leave as he punches out one of the guys, and we cut to John telling him that he needs a ride.
Yeah, not, he punches the son out, which is the important thing.
Yes, yes, he punches out Yosef.
But also, I like that he's not a pushover, because he pulls a gun on him and he's like, either you kill me or get out of my shop.
Exactly.
Yep. And I like that as soon as he sees the car, he knows. And his face just shows everything that you need to know. And it's just, where did you get that car? And his face, that's it. It's so effective.
Yep. It's two things in his head. If they manage to kill him, then I tip my hat, because I thought that was impossible. If you just stole his car, we are all screwed.
Vigo calls Aurelio to verify that he struck his son. After Aurelio tells him that his son struck Wick and killed his dog, I love the response that Vigo gives. Oh.
This is a great choice by the writers.
Yes.
And the actor, because in most of these movies, it's they freak out, put a team together to go take him out. He'd be angry, but this, it's the, oh God, we're in trouble. Like, it's just, like, this movie is setting you up that this guy is the, in a lot of ways, this is the best Punisher movie that's ever been made, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because like, everyone is just terrified of this guy.
And you get it from everybody else's reaction. It is that mystery. It is that, and Michael Nyquist, through 90% of this film, he plays it perfectly, that he's just, as this boss, is now suddenly scared out of his mind of what's going to happen.
Second series in a row that we've reviewed Nyquist. Great story. He actually cut his head pretty badly during the shooting of one particular fighting scene in this film. He got a lot of stitches, and instead of waiting for them to heal, he just told the directors that he would wear a hat for the rest of his scenes. So if you see him in this, and he has a hat on, that is right after the stunt, and it's so inconsistent, but you don't care. Because it's a movie, right?
You'd almost pulled a Mick Foley and almost lost his ear.
Yes, it was hanging down. Oh. I mean, we gave Nyquist a pretty bad time when we reviewed Ghost Protocol because he wasn't that good of a villain in that. I think he works in this.
Oh, he doesn't just work. He's fantastic. He is, again, everybody who populates this world feels legitimate. As much as this is a candy-coated comic book horror action movie, it feels populated by characters that belong there. And he is a great version of that.
Yeah, for a movie that's this heightened, I appreciate that they did not feel the need to over-exaggerate the characters. And it would have been very easy to do that with a Russian mobster villain, which is also a cliche in and of itself. The Russian mob being the villains. How many action movies have we seen that? Again, that's another thing I think they're just having fun with. Especially the whole thing of pairs. You know, you have the wife, the dog, the car. This, you have a father and a son. To kind of parallel that.
Good call, I didn't catch that. Viggo chastises his son about stealing Wick's car, and here we get the famous fucking nobody speech about John Wick and how he got the nickname Baba Yaga, as he was the one you sent to kill the fucking boogeyman. This is pure 80s cheese that I could see Arnold playing way back in the day, but it works here too, as we're seeing flashes of Wick digging into his basement and stories of how Wick started in their organization, but the stories about him spread, and now his son, mere weeks after Wick's wife died, killed his dog and stole his car. Great stuff here.
This is also very important because it's more exposition. You know, this could have been an info dump, but it's also vague enough because he talks about, I gave him an impossible task that should have killed him. But he doesn't, don't explain what it is because it's not important. He did the thing that nobody expected him to do, so he earned his way out. And given the reputation, which borders on legend and hyperbole, that's all you need. The movie trusts you enough to, like with the dog killing, it leaves a lot of stuff up to your imagination.
I do find the shots of Wick digging into this basement, like hammering this concrete. I don't know. It was odd. I didn't really like that, but I do like the story.
I like all sides of it. And the part of it is usually, and God knows we just discussed this with the franchise we discussed previously. Sometimes when things are left out, it's because they can't think of an idea of how to do it. And here it's because it makes sense to leave it to us. We don't need to be told what the impossible task is because it's more than what he goes on here, which feels impossible. The fear that you see in Viggo of, or just respect and just the, oh shit, this is like you woke up Jason Voorhees and you are screwed. You know that there is nothing you can do about it. And then when he's here in his basement, I love that it is the visual representation of him digging up his past to go back to work.
Yeah, he's literally unburying a casket.
Even when he opens it, you see those coins. We don't know why yet. The weapons that are involved, everything here feels like it is such a part of a world and not something that's just bought off a shelf that we've seen a million times.
What I like about this is the inverse of the effect, because most of these movies, you fear the villains. The villains fear the hell out of our hero, and it works for this. I'm glad that Reeves fought to have the name changed to John Wick, because the movie is about John Wick and people's fear of him.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wish they called it Baba Yaga or something, because I just hate, it's like Aaron Brockovich, where we can't think of anything, so we're just going to name it after the title character. It makes me want to see Chad Stahelski do a Batman movie, because this is how Batman should be feared by like low-life modern like criminals. The way they react is how he's being presented. And the coins, the gun, it's here for a reason. We just don't know why. And I also love, stylistically, we talked about this a little bit, or at least Adam did, the way the subtitles are not just used, it's not just static white text. They move around, they exaggerate certain words, they'll use different color palettes, put them in different spots, because it alleviates the problem of subtitles. They're important because this movie has a lot about the world and, you know, the Russians and secrets. So the subtitles are an inevitability. And they find a way to make it creative and stylistically match the movie. Because if they were just white text, it'd be kind of distracting and boring.
Yeah, but it makes doing the plot summary of this a pain in the ass. So Viggo calls John to try to make nice, but Wick has none of it and just hangs up.
Again, Keanu, they know he was at his best, but he doesn't talk. He hears him out a little bit, and he just hangs up the phone. And that's scarier than anything he could have said to him.
The funness and little bit of just joy that they get, that this scene where he's got like a phone book, you know, and he's flipping through it, trying to find the number. It's just, I don't know. It's a little detail that just fleshes this out. They know when to break it for a little bit of levity for a film that could be so heavy and so dour.
We see John get out of the shower and put on a suit as Viggo asks how many men his associates have. Wick takes out some thugs in his house, and this is when we start seeing gun-fu being used for the first time in this series. I like this. I like the fact that it's in the dark. I like the fact that this is the first time we're seeing John Wick in action, but he's just kind of getting back into the flow of it.
Yeah, he's a little rusty because guys can hit him. It takes him a while to stab that guy at the end. Like, his killer instinct hasn't fully returned. It's like muscle memory, you know? You gotta get back into the swing of things. Because what I love about this movie, unlike so many action stars around this time, like even Ethan Hunt to a certain degree, John Wick can be hurt. He bleeds. He gets broken arms. He has to get stitches. So he doesn't feel like the impenetrable superhero that this character could have been. Because as much as I like the Taken movie, singular, being the first one, and The Equalizer, which I love, Denzel barely breaks a sweat in that. Like, it's almost comical how easily he takes people out. This, I appreciate, it's a struggle for him, despite the fact that he has the precision of Bullseye. There are more headshots in this than the entire run of Call of Duty when I was a kid. Like, it's insane.
Yeah, the whole thing of him being vulnerable, that's true for this, but let's put a pin in that for later on in the series.
I love the choreography and the work that they put into making this, the shooting of it, the lighting. This is one of the just great action scenes of that decade. It's done so, so well. And the work that went into it, it is seamless. It feels, you know, it feels one shot-ish. You know, it flows very, very smooth. The editing, when it gets to these action scenes, can't be commended enough because it is so well done. But the Foley work, the choreography, the shooting, the lighting, it is running on all cylinders.
Thank God for wide shots. By this point, I was so done with quick cuts and overly edited action sequences. Like, I mean, Taken 3, there's that whole scene where he's climbing the fence and there's like 8 cuts. Now, this has the benefit of you have stunt people directing these. Yes. And you have an actor who's doing the stuff, so it's going to naturally look better. But be that as it may, it was a welcome addition at the time that this came out.
Well, he's no Tom Cruise, but the number they threw out for how many stunts he did, they said that he did 90% of his stunts. He put in the work. He worked really hard at this role, and it showed. I respect him in this. Also, Adam, you mentioned the long shots. That was out of necessity. They didn't have the money to make this flashy. They had enough to do a shot a few times, and then they were done. So they just decided to take these scenes and choreograph them to the point where they did do long shots, and it worked for this character because it's all one fluid motion. Especially when we get to the club later, that really works for this character and this movie.
It also helps that we know the layout of this house.
Yes. Yeah, the geography is very important. If you look at Die Hard, the reason why the first Die Hard really works is because you know the geography of that building. You know where he's going. When he goes to the floor with the magazine pictures, you know where he is. And they do the same thing here. We have established this house before we get to this scene. You're right, that really helps this scene. So Wick takes one guy out by stabbing him in either the neck or chest. I really couldn't tell as the doorbell rings with red sirens outside. And I love how John is just in with the cops. They know each other on a first name basis. Again, the reputation of Wick precedes him.
This, again, this type of world building, you know that there's something else out there that is a part of this world that John is a part of, and he recognizes John. He knows what's going on here, and he doesn't need to spell it out. Hey, John, are you back to your old life while you are doing this and this? Are these guys from big? You don't need that. Working again? The less is more approach has never worked as well as it has through most of this film.
I think to Matt's point, that's them working toward Keanu Reeves' strength.
Yeah.
Also, this is how you put in comedic beats.
Yes, which it needed right here.
Dry. Yeah, very dry.
Like, it's very dry wit, mm-hmm. but it's also done with a wink and a nod. Like, it's, hey, if it was really that bad, then I would come in, but I trust you handled it. He's like, good night, Jimmy. He just leaves.
Yeah. He tells Jimmy that he's not working again. He just ordered some stuff out. And we see John going through some gold coins as Charlie shows up with some friends. I guess these guys are like the wolf in Pulp Fiction. They just clean up dirty and violent messes.
Oh, they literally are. But also, yep. This is never established. Like, there was no setup for this at all. But I really appreciate that they just go with it. And they tell you, hey, trust us. All of this feels like he's done this before.
And I love the fact that Wick is associated with all these different factions, but to your guys' point, we're not establishing what these are or who they are. We just know they exist, and the fact that they're here cleaning up, we know what they do. We don't need an explanation.
Never the way that he picks up the phone, dials a number. Hey, I need takeout for, takeout for six.
Yeah.
Sounds like he's making a dinner call. It's just so well done.
Also, these guys must love movies because this is the guy. He was the main villain of The Warriors, and he was also in The Crow.
Yeah, he was on The Crow. Yeah, I guarantee he's a friend of one of those guys.
Which is funny because I think this movie actually has a lot in common with The Crow.
No, it doesn't.
Especially with the...
What?
No, okay. Hear me out. Not the supernatural shit, but the cinematography and the lens. This feels like it almost could be in that world. And the whole thing of like resurrection, it's not literal, but it's there.
So Viggo puts a $2 million contract on John Wick. We cut to Defoe making some vegetable smoothies as we see him approach Viggo, who asks him to kill Wick for $2 million. And Defoe just says, consider it done. And I like this red herring. We think this is where Defoe's going, but of course he has other plans.
Well, yeah, because Willem Dafoe is going to turn into Willem Dafriend.
Oh my fucking God. Oh my God.
But that's also like fine because Willem Dafoe's played more villains than he has good guys. Like,
well, hell, even when he's playing good guys, he's playing villains. You see fucking Boondock Saints?
But yeah, I like that he asks him here if it's an open contract. And when he tells him it's open, that means he knows other people are going to be gunning for John.
That's exactly it. That's his whole plan is to, even though since it's an open contract, he can help Wick out. So yeah, I like that as well. Killing strangers from Marilyn Manson plays as we see a little montage of guns being put together and Wick driving through the streets. We see John run into Perkins and what we'll come to know as the Continental. More on this as the series goes on. He puts down a coin and is given 818, and he's told it's a pleasure having him here.
Again, which is the key word.
Yeah, having him here again, correct. And by the way, RIP Lance Reddick, he is such a fun presence in this series. I'm sad he's no longer with us, but I loved him in this role.
Well, he's very much the, it's almost like the Q, where it's like you're always happy to see him, and he's kind of the guy. Yeah, Winston's in charge, but he's really the guy who does the day-to-day stuff. But you also, if you're looking at this from a, if you want to get philosophical, because I think this movie actually is. I mean, we've talked about resurrection and that kind of stuff. You could perceive him as the ferryman between worlds, like heaven and hell. Like this, the Continental is almost purgatory.
Hmm.
Where it's, no
actually had that note that he's Chiron. Yep.
Yeah. Like no business can be conducted. The literal gold coins, you had to pay the ferryman to get across the river. Light and dark, everyone shades of gray. Like they're contract killers. I also like this world. There's an established code, but they don't feel like they have to explain it.
Yeah, we'll get those.
There's a lot. There's a lot going on here. I mean, this is very comic book ish.
Oh yeah.
Graphic novel-ish, I would definitely say. We see John once again watching the video of him and his wife as he goes down the elevator. He heads to the hotel bar where he meets up with Winston, played by Ian McShane, though it was originally cast as Jason Isaacs, who pulled out. I love Ian McShane here. I think his dry humor really works.
Yeah, I could have seen Jason Isaacs, though. That's good casting. But this is also one of the things you get a great actor to work opposite Keanu Reeves, because Ian McShane can put a lot of spin on those lines. Like, he savors every word. I mean, he's got a very pronounced voice as it is, so it's kind of recognizable. But I like it's like, I'm happy to see you, but I have no clue why you're here, and that kind of concerns me.
This stuff here, once we get to the Continental again, is just brilliant. And I gotta say, with Ian McShane and Lance Reddick here, we get a sort of reunion of Hellboy and Professor Bloom. Me and McShane was in Hellboy 2019, and Lance Reddick played Hellboy in the Web of Wired video game that just came out recently. So,
oh, wow.
If it's Hellboy, I'm dropping it. But also, just when Wick was at the bar and the girl who recognizes him, you got out. Oh, shit, you're back in. You know, there's something about he's being dragged back down to hell, and these demons almost wish he could have stayed away.
Winston asks if he should be giving the beatings instead of receiving them, and warns Wick about getting back into the game, but Wick isn't bothered by this.
Which, this is also a thing that very few action movies have done. Like, Hitman stories, what happens when you get out, like, completely? Because he's right. Yep. Like, as soon as you come back, you don't get a second chance at that.
We see Viggo head to the Continental. Meanwhile, Wick tells Winston it's personal after Winston tells him no business is supposed to be conducted on the Continental premises. Again, establishing the rules here. We see this chick, Addie. She approaches Wick and she asks him how life is on the other side. She tells him that she's never seen him so vulnerable. He then gets a drink, compliments of the house. We cut to
what does it say? It says like red circle on the napkin.
Yeah. We cut to a club as Wick changes clothes and gears up. I do like the club scene a lot. I like how the guards have subtitles as the music drowns out their words. That was a nice touch. And
I like that they also show him wearing a bulletproof vest.
In this one, yep.
You have to show that to explain why he's not dead.
I like how Kevin Nash took a break from tearing his quad long enough to let Wick by with this code word, where he's basically asking him how many people are here, and he gives the code. That was a nice touch that I didn't catch until this viewing.
Well, I also like he's playing the same character he did in The Punisher, right? Yeah. Down to being a freaking Russian.
Russian, yes, I thought of that too.
I have a feeling these guys know each other and have hung out and maybe played music or something. You know, I just got that feeling.
I like how these red-shirted henchmen direct homage to Star Trek. I like seeing Wick. He's shoving this guy's face in the sink, throwing off the balcony. I always think of Jim Ross at him when he's just like, some idiot at home is saying he knows how to fall. But this was a stunt that Reeves wanted to do, but producers were like, uh-uh, you're not doing this one. So somehow, some way, they got someone to fall off this balcony, and my God, what a hit.
That pronounced thud when he hits the dance floor.
Oh my God, which I know was touched up, but still, that just looked painful.
Yeah, but it's that sound that when Big Show threw Mick Foley onto the Buried Alive set, it's just that loud thud where it's like there's no way to cushion it.
This entire sequence between the lighting, the music, the subtitles, the choreography is just like, this is a movie in and of itself that's stunning to watch.
And you also never lose track because he's chasing him.
Yes, he's chasing Yosuke.
Clearly, you know just how close or how far away he is from him. And they do the cliche thing of him taking out the big muscly guy, like stepping on his foot. I like how John Wick, he's very generous. He has enough bullets. They go around because he unloads like 5 shots into him.
I do like that the bullet count matters, that you see him have to change magazines, that you see it. I go to Archer, who's just like, what do you mean you don't know how many, you didn't count your bullets? I have the feeling that Wick is always counting every single shot.
And apparently Reeves had a 104 degree fever while shooting the entire duration of this scene, and you can't tell. And I like the 2 shots in the gut, 1 in the head. You know, that's something that I remember from Zombieland.
Always a headshot.
Yes. Yep.
Put him down.
Broken glass. All the money's on the screen here. And that's one thing I do respect about this movie. As I mentioned, this thing had a little north of $20 million spent on it. Not exactly a high budget, but all the money's on the screen and you can definitely tell.
They used every dollar to its fullest extent, probably down to every penny.
Yep. An example of saving money. Some guys died 2-3 times because they couldn't afford more extras. So they just dressed them up in different clothes, different facial hair, and put them on and had Reeves kill them all right there on set. We see glass in the face, and I like Reeves pulling this guy by the beard to the counter. And then we see Yosef. He panics in the car as he calls Victor. Wick answers it and just says, Victor's dead. Total 80s moment there, but it works. This doctor, by the way, is the key maker from the Matrix sequels. Once again, Keanu Reeves calling in favors.
That's awesome. Like, I recognize him immediately. And if you don't know, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
If you know, it's awesome.
We see Marcus, Willem Dafoe's character, set up his gun as John lays down. He focuses scope right at John and then shoots next to him. Perkins then comes in and scuffles with John. The phone rings as they scuffle some more, and Marcus keeps shooting in the room. And I love how Sharon is just calm on the other side of the line as Wick is dealing with this chick. Adrian Pilecki, fun seeing her here. She was, a lot of people don't remember, she was originally going to be Wonder Woman in a TV show that David Kelly was producing way back when. But I liked seeing her here.
Good present. Yeah, watch that pilot. Oof. That script was insulting to women and Wonder Woman. She had another one who brings a presence here that's believable, and I like seeing her here.
Oh, yeah, especially this is kind of against type from what she was playing at the time. Because I know her from Friday Night Lights.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think she was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I couldn't tell you who she played, but...
Yeah, she was Mockingbird.
Oh, that's right.
So John flips her on the table, puts a sheet over her head, and then pushes her out a window.
No, he doesn't push her out the window. He punches her in the face.
Punches her in the face, yeah.
I love that they're willing to let her take the shots. They're not going to do that thing where she can't get hit or bring in a woman to have a fight. She attacked John. He's going to knock her ass out.
Yeah, this is at the how could you? I'm a woman.
Sharon lets John know that he's been getting complaints of the noise emitting from his room. Perkins says that she's not telling him shit, but she divulges that they are in a church in Little Russia. That's a front where Vigo keeps his private stash. John's interrupted by Harry, who asks if John is all right before John asks if he wants to earn a coin. It's weird. These coins are so bizarre. We're going to get more on these, obviously, as the series goes on. But at this point, it's almost like Super Mario Brothers or Scott Pilgrim. Like, they're just kind of here. Are they rewards for things? How does he get these coins? It's another mystery that is introduced.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a mystery as much as it is, like, just another aspect of how they operate. I also like how it's just nonchalant, like he was with the cops. Like, hey, Harry, how's it going?
Yeah. John takes out some priests in the church before heading to the vault. Wick raids the money and then jokers it by setting it on fire.
Oh, this is right out of Man on Fire. He does this.
Yes. We cut to Harry, who has Perkins duty, and she asks if he wants to earn more than one coin. She says fuck management before shooting Harry through a pillow. Meanwhile, Wick gets in a gunfight before Vigo captures him. And this is one part of the movie I didn't like. We get this huge... James Bond is way in the rearview mirror. Why do we get a James Bond type speech detailing that people don't change, times change? I hated that Vigo did this. Doesn't work.
Well, before we get to that, I love that this movie, people don't just get hit with cars. People get assaulted by cars multiple times.
The car foo in this film is another one that's just, it's stunning stunt work.
Yeah, and there's not a whole lot of space to operate because they're on like a side street of the city block.
Yeah, and there were times when they were like, look, we only have time for one shot. And the coordinator was like, we can get it done. And yeah, this is the result. It's not as huge as we're going to get in future movies, but it works for this one for sure. So, Matt, you're going to talk about the interrogation here.
I think this is kind of a sharp critique of the villain espousing their plans to the captive hero. So I think this is much more tongue-in-cheek, especially with how stilted Keanu's line reads are with the yeah I'm thinking I'm back. Like, I think it's kind of acknowledging how silly it is.
Seems like the type of thing where you need to film something to also shoot for a trailer, and that's you know, this is a trailer scene here. It's okay, but this, yeah, I said Vigo's great in about 90% of this. This is part of it where I'm like, yeah, I'm not buying what he was scared of the Baba Yaga earlier.
Yeah, this is definitely a scene I put in the intro for this.
Well, it's also false confidence, but it's also like him peacocking because it's false confidence because he's got him tied up.
Yeah.
And that's fitting because this movie is on Peacock right now.
Gee, and I get shit for the Willem Dafoe pun. Jesus, at least mine was actually clever.
I am getting no laughs. I'm really sad. Vigo then tells Wick when he got his wife, Vigo had his son, and believe me, you got the better deal. Which, again, Nyquist is delivering these lines very well. He says that this life follows you and it affects everyone who gets close to you, and Wick replies that on that, we agree. Vigo then says it was just a dog, and we get the one time when, Matt, you complimented this, but Keanu stretches too far. He gives this speech that he just can't find passion in.
This is when I do. I need this. To me, this, it shows where his snap was, and I am all for it.
It does allow him to escape, though, and we get this fight with a goon, and Wick takes him out. He then shoots a driver through the window and fires at Vigo. Vigo gives his son's location, and of course, Yosef is playing a shoot 'em up video game, douchebag. Wick uses a sniper rifle and takes a few guys out as Vigo, what, meditates? What's he doing here? Praying that Wick doesn't find him?
He's smoking a joint.
He's smoking a joint.
Knowing that he sent his, offered up his son for himself.
Wick then uses a damn grenade. He's not fucking around and blows up the cars in the warehouse. He finally finds Yosef and takes him out.
Part of this. I love that he literally shoots Yosef mid-sentence and walks away.
That was awesome.
The way that it's done is such a great stylistic choice.
Vigo answers the phone and then just says, make the arrangements. He knew Yosef was dead the second he said that he killed Wick's dog. Marcus asks Wick, how many times do I have to save your ass? And then asks him if he really believes he's retired. Marcus then tells Wick that it's time to go home. And then we see Marcus get cornered by someone as Wick gets a phone call from Vigo saying Marcus betrayed him by not filling his contract. Marcus then pays for not protecting his son by getting shot by Vigo. I hated seeing Dafoe go. I thought at the time I saw this, I'm like, wow, he'll be fun in sequels. Nope, they take him out.
Well, I think it's needed because you want to give him as little, you know, he's had that backup for the whole movie. What happens when that's gone? We need to see him at his full, like, I don't want to say potential, but you kind of got to level the playing field.
Yes, but also this movie ended 5 minutes ago. And I feel like the rest of it is pretty tacked on. So I think this is also, this scenes here is to set up, you know, Viggo as somebody who is going to go toe-to-toe with John here in a few minutes. But for me, this film ended. And this is just, this entire rest of it is a little lesser than what we've got up to here.
Wick finds Marcus's body as Winston revokes Perkins' membership at the Continental by shooting her dead.
Oh, this is great. Like, they talk about heavy penalties.
Yes.
They're like, oh,
yep, thinking monetary? I do like this a lot.
Yeah, you're thinking monetary? No, she gets death by firing squad.
Wick goes after Viggo and a car chase is on. The car with Viggo crashes into a fire hydrant as Wick takes out some guys. Wick then reloads as the driver gets out and calls Viggo a Russian cocksucker.
Now, again, we don't just have some random henchmen. This is Mayhem, who I can't help but see those freaking commercials every time I see that dude on screen, and he'll never be anything else.
Wick takes out the driver by crashing into him sideways. More parfoo, but here's Viggo to push Wick's car down a ditch as Wick jumps out. Pouring down rain, echoing the end of The Matrix Revolutions. Because of course it is. As Viggo,
yeah, but there's no Dragon Ball Z bullshit in this.
As Viggo says, no more guns, it's just you and me. And you know what? I'm surprised at how much Viggo holds his own here.
Yes, I'm also very surprised at how much he holds his own here, because he sure as hell shouldn't be able to. Agreed, they're probably the same age, but hair dye and beard dye goes a long way of making you look 15 years younger. But I've never felt like these two would be able to go mano a mano. And so it feels awkward with watching them go on fisticuffs here. It just does. I understand why you want to do it. I get it from a structure standpoint. Yusuf deserved the bullet to the head mid-sentence. You need a little more here. But it's just, this part is, it's all right. I do like that Winston was willing to break his own rules to give him the info.
Yeah, he did it through a technicality. So technically, he didn't break his own rules. He got someone else to do it. I think this is fine, because I'm looking at this also. He's got the endurance advantage, because this movie takes place over a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is his first time doing anything of this sort in God knows how long. So I don't have that problem of him going one-on-one with the big boss at the end, because it's kind of like The Raid, where he's already got the shit kicked out of him before getting to this fight. Like, if this was, oh, I'll see you at dawn, and he had like a day to rest, then I'd probably have more issue. But that fact, we've seen him shot, we've seen him hit by cars, he's been thrown off a floor,
yeah.
He's got stitches, he's on painkillers. Like, there's enough of pretext as far as his state that I buy this. That I feel like it's as even as it could be. And even then, it's not a drag-out fight.
Wick takes Viggo down as Viggo tells him he'll be seeing him. We then cut to the scene that we saw at the beginning of the movie as Wick watches the end of the video on his phone, pulls himself up, and walks into a dog shelter. Okay, so as somebody who is marrying somebody who is the head of HR at an animal shelter, this is not a good location for a goddamn animal shelter.
Those dogs also deserve to be in better cages than freaking those temp ones that they have sitting out there.
Wick hears a dog yelling, and he finds this pit bull that is about to be put down. So instead of a cute little beagle that he had at the beginning, now he's got a big manly dog. I thought this was kind of a betrayal.
Well, he's now no longer the suburban dad. Well, suburban husband, because he doesn't have kids. But getting a dog that can fit his new lifestyle, because this is him, like, by killing Viggo, he's like, oh, there's no going back.
And credits roll on John Wick. All right, scale of 1 to 10, what do we give John Wick? Adam, go ahead, sir.
As I said at the beginning of this is a film that I missed out on until after the second one had come out. Everybody was talking about the franchise at that point with a sequel. I gotta see it. So I finally sat down and watched John Wick. And this is one of the best 90 minutes that you can spend. This thing is brisk. This thing is as fast paced as the action going throughout. But in that time, it still does an amazing amount of storytelling, of world building, of character development. And I appreciate the hell out of that. This is, some people may get pissed at this. I don't care. This is as much as a revelation in this kind of genre as Pitch Black was when that came out. It knows what it is. It's not going to baby you with extra exposition to explain what's going on. It's just going to put you in the world and say, we're telling the story. Come along with us on this journey. Follow us on this ride. And I love it for that. Keanu is being directed and written to his strengths. And I think that's to his benefit. And I think he has realized that as the series goes along. This thing is directed within an inch of its life. It is choreographed within an inch of its life. The music throughout, this is the kind of music I pop for. This is my kind of soundtrack and score here. The gunfu, the colors, the cinematography, the lighting, even the way that the rain is used but not too overly done, wait for sequels, is just top notch. I wish I would have seen this in theaters, but as it is, I've seen this movie, God, I don't know, 6 to 8 times since, and I'm still happy every single time I watch it. This is a strong 8 on 10. There's little stuff here and there. I don't necessarily dig the fight with Vigo at the end, but I appreciate not just what this movie sets up, but that it exists. I wish we had more $30, $40 million movies of this type being done, because this shows that when you're hamstrung with a budget, talent shines through and your ability shines through. And fuck, I wish Hollywood would learn this lesson, not sequelitis.
So 8 on 10?
8 on 10 for Baba Yaga.
All right. 8 on 10 from Adam. Matt, what about you, sir?
I'm sort of in a similar boat. This makes, in hindsight, me even more upset at Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, because look at the money that was used on that movie for something so slop hazard versus this, which is so expertly put together and doesn't waste your time. They used every resource they had to its fullest potential and made something that, by all accounts, should not have worked as well as it does. I mean, you combine the actor being where they were, unproven directors on that front, both in marketability and careers. But it's also one of the great surprises in both a singular installment and what it spawned. Like, this on the surface should not have worked in any capacity. I think this is akin to something like the first Terminator, where that movie was made for pennies on the dollar compared to, you know, larger scale productions at the time. This is kind of the same thing. And it's also showing that sometimes when you're forced to use what you have and you don't have that safety net of millions of dollars to fall back on, you got to make every shot count like your titular hero does. And they do. I mean, there's a reason I saw this twice in a row, like literally back to back. So I can't go at like a 10 or a 9. But as it is, this is a very, very, very strong 8 on 10.
Holy smoking lizards, I hate when this happens, because I had the same score written down. I'll say this. This plot is as antiquated as a powdered wig. How many times have we seen this type of plot in these movies, especially the three of us? And Adam, you and I grew up on these types of plots. But if this is trash, call me a raccoon, because I love this movie. You don't go to this movie for the plot. You go to see Keanu Reeves kill people who are built like vending machines. And that's exactly what we get in this. On top of that, he is as angry as I would be if somebody killed my dog. I would be out for revenge too. I have a really good time every time I watch this movie. Unfortunately, I haven't watched this movie too much over the years. It also has to be said too that this movie came out at a time when the action genre was relegated to, and I like these films at the time, but it was a comic book movie world in 2014. There was no original IP that had the same kind of impact that this one did when it was released. And I am all for original IPs. I think this movie is a fun time. It is the most stripped down movie we're going to get in this entire series. I still haven't seen Ballerina yet, but I am willing to go out on that ledge. I enjoy this movie a lot. I think this resurrected Keanu Reeves' career. I think this resurrected the action genre. And when you have a movie like this, when you have an unexpected movie that came out with almost zero hype and have the impact on basically society, because this not only spawned a few sequels and a tie-in, but it also has a freaking Peacock TV show. I enjoy this movie a lot. I am also at an 8 out of 10. I don't know if I'm going to go higher as we go into the series. Maybe I will, but I had a much better time than I was expecting, honestly, revisiting this. So 8 out of 10 for John Wick. All right, guys. Next week, we're going to get John Wick Chapter 2. This was one I did go see in theaters. I was pretty excited for it. Adam, what are you expecting when we discuss John Wick Chapter 2 next week?
I expect bullets to be flying. I think we're going to get some comparisons. I think we're going to get some differing views. I think we're going to start with some of that. And I think we're going to get some questionable decisions. I can't wait to have that discussion because, yeah, I think this is going to be I think we're going to get some firefights throughout this thing, and I can't fucking wait. You know what I love is even going into this one, I knew we had all seen it. I'd love that we did not discuss it, and I had no idea how we were all going to go into this film. And that's the same with all of these. I have no idea how we're all going to feel.
Matt, what about you, sir?
Oh, I almost broke my legs running to the theater when this finally came out because it took a little over 2 years. I could not have been more excited. I thought this actually, in an era that is defined by IPs and franchises that way, to get something that organically justified it, I fully endorsed.
Yeah, as I had mentioned, I saw this first one way after its original theatrical run, though the fortunate thing about doing that is that I saw it just a couple months before Chapter 2 was released, so needless to say, I was excited. I didn't have to wait as long as most people did. So yeah, I was there opening weekend as well. I can't wait to discuss that. Had an experience, and I'm with Adam. I think next week might be differing opinions. We'll see. But until next week, when we get to John Wick Chapter 2, your membership to this podcast has been, by thine own hand, revoked. Thank you, boys.
So, you want to kill him? You want to kill him? I want to kill him. What about you, Mr. Vic?
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, for better, of course, yeah. But it looks like we have ourselves a genuine conundrum.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Just have fun, Albert.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
What have you done? Finished it.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series, Lethal Weapon series, the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, Avatar,
Mission Impossible film series,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
A man can stay here a long time and never eat the same meal twice.
Good day to you both.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Well, sometimes you gotta cut a motherfucker.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I have enjoyed his company.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Consider this a professional courtesy.
Scheduling done by Matt.
He's coming again.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Jonathan, just walk away.
Yeah, Jonathan, walk away.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
John Wick is a man of focus.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
He's excommunicado.
Unless you wish to become the same, I suggest you lower your guard.
We gotta go. Now.
You weren't lying, Matt. You knew this was going to go long, didn't you?
Yeah, well, like the entity, I see everything.
All right. Let's stop talking about that stupid movie. Let's get to this one.
Something we all thought was going to be very stupid.
Oh, my God. Yeah, definitely. It was picked up. The studio liked this idea. Although at that time, it was called something else.
Scorn?
Yeah, at that time it was called Scorn.
I think I'll remember it as John Wick more than anything else.
More than Matrix, huh?
Well, you gotta remember, I didn't grow up, like, I grew up in the aftermath of The Matrix, where everyone was copying it. I didn't see them till I was like 13. Part of it was because I was told, yeah, watch the first one and skip the rest. But we'll definitely review that franchise because there is going to be another one. They've talked about it. So
and I still haven't seen franchise. The last one they did.
What?
No. I've been waiting for us to do that series in order to watch it.
Yeah, me too. This is, I have a feeling these guys know each other and have hung out and maybe played music or something. You know, I just, it was Dogstar. I just got that feeling.
Well, Keanu Reeves does have a certain resemblance to Scott Hall. Especially with that beard.
Matt, really making the connections here. I like, and I love how Sharon. How do you say that? Charon. Is that Sharon?
I think Sharon.
Okay, and I love how Sharon is